Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things that we got going on over there. Could be that you're like, man, I ain't got time for no other podcast. I'm 40 minutes in the Old Testament all day, every day because I'm behind. That's fine. You just keep on plugging away until you're caught up. But one day in the future, when you are caught up, and then you're in this habit, you're listening to podcasts 7 hours a day, and you're caught up with our podcast, and you don't know what to do, well, then maybe you can go over there, check out those other podcasts. We can fill that time for you. We got your back. While you're over there, you might notice that donate button that's up there in the right-hand corner. That's there just for you. And you can click on that, and you can do your little part in something big. Make us able to keep doing the things that we do for free for the world, and if you have done that, we appreciate it very much. Chad, events are coming upon us, man. We're getting close.
We got a bunch coming up.
Springtime, man. Things are alive. City events are alive. It's spring. I mean, it's not spring yet, but when it is, the city events are flourishing. That's how
it works.
We got
like three coming up, right?
Bam, bam, bam. Yeah, March, April, and May. The one that's closest, Austin, and that's just a couple weeks away. Austin is March 9th, so I'll be there, Chad will be there, Donovan Riley, Scott Keith, Valerie Locklear, and Daniel Van Voris in Austin, Texas. You guys should come out. It's free. You can't afford not to. It's free for you. All you got to do is go over to Christel Fast, go to the City Events page, click on it. You can register for nothing. And even if you didn't register and you just decided last minute to show up, you could do that. But if you know you're coming, let us know you're coming. It helps us out to know how many people to expect. But maybe you're like, Austin, I live in the Midwest, dude. I ain't going down to Texas. That's fine, because we got you in Des Moines, Iowa, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. So Midwest covered.
We'll bring Texas to you.
That's right. Bringing Texas to you. That's what we're doing. Bringing the South to you up there in the Midwest. We have to schedule those a little later because you guys, in your cold weather, we don't want any of it. So we'll be there in April and May. Iowa and Minneapolis, you can go over to the City Events page, check those out. Registration for those, also free. Chad, what's going on in the Book of Numbers? Man, we're starting to wind down here. I can feel the wind down before we get to the longest sermon in the Bible.
Yeah, we are like, you know, we have reached the altitude, and now we are beginning the descent. So it will not be long at all. We are beginning of chapter 33 right now. I might say one thing about chapter 32 that I don't think I said last time, and then we're going to rush on along. We'll see how far we get this time, but I would say within an episode and a half, then don't call me a false prophet, it doesn't happen, but within an episode and a half, we should be getting right there to the end of Numbers and ready to jump into Deuteronomy.
Yeah, there you go. I had someone send us a message, and he said, what book are you guys starting next? And I said, Deuteronomy. He said, oh, yeah, I should have figured that. Which I took as, I was kind of hoping maybe you guys would jump into something else.
Oh, Deuteronomy would be good.
Yeah, man, once you get through, I mean, we got through Leviticus and Numbers, man. Like, Deuteronomy is, like exciting by comparison.
Yeah, Deuteronomy's like, that's Moses at his finest. That's his swan song. So, it's going to be good.
It's going to be great, yeah. We'll be back in that narrative soon enough.
We will be, yeah. Joshua is, we'll be here before we know it. So, back to 32, one thing I want to say about that, like I mentioned, I don't remember if I actually said this or just thought it. But in chapter 32, that's where you have the two and a half tribes of Reuben and Gad and that half tribe of Manasseh, Joseph's son, where they decide that, hey, the grazing is so good on the other side of the Jordan, in the Trans-Jordan, that we just want to stay here. Is that okay? And of course, Moses overreacts because he thinks that they're rebelling against the Lord's gift. But everything works its way out in the end because they kind of make a compromise. And these two and a half tribes said, listen, we will be the Marines. We're going to be the first boots on the ground when you cross over the Jordan to conquer the Promised Land. And we're going to bear the brunt of the battle. So we're not going to like just stay here and let our brothers cross the Jordan and do all the work. Instead, we're gonna go ahead of you. We're gonna leave our wives and our children behind. We're gonna build some fortifications for them so they'll be safe. And presumably, some of the men would stay behind too to serve as guards for the women and children. But for the most part, the men are gonna go ahead. The fighting men are gonna go ahead of the rest of the tribes over the Jordan, and they're gonna be the Marines that clear the way. So what I wanted to say is that seven times we have this phrase that occurs in chapter 32, beginning at verse 20, that's in Hebrew, it's Lifnei Yahweh. We usually translate it something like before the Lord. So verse 20, for instance, Moses is speaking to them and says, if you will do this, that is, if you will be these troops that go ahead of everyone else, if you will arm yourselves, Lifnei Yahweh, before the Lord, for the war, and all of you will do this, et cetera, et cetera. So he's kind of setting up, if you will do this, then everything's going to be okay. Now, what I want to say is that this phrase, Lifnei Yahweh, before the Lord, occurs seven times. And it's used in other contexts, especially in battle, to indicate that what this is talking about is not simply, hey, you're going to go and you're going to fight and God's going to be there watching over you, protecting you, blessing you as you battle. But instead, this is not kind of an abstract sort of thing, like, you know, God is in your midst or something like that. This is the concrete terminology for the presence of the Ark of the Covenant with the army. So when they go before the Lord, that's just not saying, hey, God's going to be with you and bless you. This is saying that God is actually his throne. His Ark of the Covenant is going to be there with you when you go into battle. And I think a couple episodes ago, we talked about that when the Midianites were conquered by the Israelites, and Phinehas was there, and it said that they took with them the trumpets and the holy vessels of the Lord. Well, one of those would have been the Ark of the Covenant. So I think that's probably what that phrase, that sevenfold phrase, Lifnei Yahweh, before the Lord, means, is that God's going to be there, but you're actually going to see his throne covered up. So this is the visible, tangible affirmation that God is in your midst when his Ark of the Covenant goes with you.
This is why the Nazis wanted the Ark of the Covenant and Raiders of
the
Lost Ark.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody who's watched the movie knows the true biblical meaning of
that's right. Of that. That's right. They didn't want to just like have God, you know, sort of with, you know, watching them. They're like, hey, we're at war here. Let's go. Let's get that Ark. We don't want to look at it. We're going to march it into battle with us.
Exactly. Thank God for Indiana Jones. Just imagine what would have happened.
Yeah, if they had that, geez, who knows?
Yeah, our future would have been different.
Yeah,
I saw like the Man in the High Castle, right?
I flipped through TV the other day, and just so happened that the Raiders of the Lost Ark was on, and I just stopped on it, and it was the end of it, and you know, where the dude like opens it up and stuff, and like his face melts off. Those special effects didn't hold up too well over the last however long it's been, 30 years or whatever.
Anytime my wife and I watch an old movie like that, like from the '80s or something. You got all these special effects back then. We just end up laughing. You know, yeah. It can be like a totally serious scene or supposed to be scary or something, and we're just cracking up because the special effects are so outdated.
Yeah, like my daughter was just sitting there, and she was laughing. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't laugh when I saw that.
No, so back then, that was like, wow. That was jaw-dropping awesome.
Yeah, that was terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. No, anyway, so, yeah, so it's not it's not just, you know, before the Lord. So in other words, like God is going to see you. It's that he's going to be in your midst and this is an interesting thing about God, locale, right? Isn't related, but it's related to the locale of God. Sure, God's omnipresent, right? I mean, he's everywhere. We know this about God, that you can't escape his sight, right? This is a biblical concept. There's no hiding from him. When he's wandering around the garden looking for Adam and Eve, he knows where they are. He sees everything. But God is not located in all places in the same way. So an Old Testament example would be the Ark of the Covenant. So, of course, God is with them in the sense that he's with everyone. He's everywhere. But he's located where the Ark of the Covenant is in a specific way doing a specific thing. This is the same kind of thing that happens in, you know, baptism and the Lord's Supper and this kind of thing. Like, we're places that he's promised to be doing a certain thing is different than sort of just the general God is everywhere thing. So God, the God that you're looking for out in the field of flowers trying to get spiritual, is not, you're not going to find God there the same way that you're going to find God in the bread and wine at the Lord's table.
Yeah, you know, I think this is one of the truths that is, broadly speaking, absent in a lot of churches today. Mm-hmm. You know, this understanding of the localized imminent presence of God, and it's not only missing, but when it is talked about, its Old Testament background is often left off, because yeah, you have that already from the beginning. I mean, you have that actually geographically in the Garden of Eden, right? God is in all creation, of course, but where does he go walking? Well, he goes walking in the garden in the cool of the day. That's where he takes his stroll. He doesn't walk around on the other side of the globe. That is the specific place where he's located. And then that becomes that location, divine location theme, just permeates the rest of the scriptures.
Yeah, and one thing that when they do talk, I mean, the presence of God is a phrase that is not absent from most churches. In fact, it's probably too dominant in a lot of churches, but it's not connected with anything. It's not connected with any word from God that this is where I'll be. It's just sort of the presence of God. And you'll try to usher in the presence of God, which just means that you feel it's a thicker feeling, right? You feel like he's more present than he was earlier. But you don't really have to do that, because God has already promised to be specifically present, but with certain things. So it's a very rare thing for God to just show up under the forms of nothing. I'm not saying like he doesn't ever do it in the scriptures, where God just, you know, the presence of God just shows up like that. I mean, it's certainly happened, but you don't have to like try to make that happen. And it's a rare thing for it to happen when he said, "I'm always right here." And I'm mm-hmm. always right over here, and this thing, and the other thing. It's always connected with these physical things, Ark of the Covenant, and the temple, and bread and wine, and all of this kind of stuff.
This is the way that God constantly reaffirms that he continues to be the creator, right?
Right.
So it's not like, when you're past Genesis chapter 2, then God kind of lays aside that work of creating. He's done. Everything's made, and now he's going to move on to whatever's next. No, I mean, he is the creator, and one of the ways that he continues to manifest his work of creation is by choosing certain elements in creation to make his localized presence available to us. So when you have these elements of creation, whether it's the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament, or the Garden of Eden, or the sacrifices, or whatever it might be, or in the New Testament, the water of baptism, or the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper, or the spoken word. I mean, all of this stuff of creation, where God puts his promises, is a way of him continually affirming to us, I am the creator, and I'm not just in the sense of I'm super powerful and I can make all things, but I'm the creator in the sense that my love is embedded in the stuff of creation. This is where I come to you. I may be the creator, but when I'm coming to you and blessing you, I'm coming to you in the forms of creation, because you yourself are not this kind of spiritual beings trapped in a body. You are a good and an image-bearing creation, part of creation. And so I come to you not just in sort of ethereal ways, but I come to you in the stuff of creation, because that's who you are. And of course, all this just funnels into the ultimate manifestation of God in creation, that's in the incarnation. So you could say that all the Old Testament there's a great Old Testament introduction by Horace Hummel called the word becoming flesh. So it's an Old Testament introduction, but it's the word becoming flesh, because that's what the Old Testament is. It's kind of this gradual unfolding of what's going to lead to the incarnation. So all these incarnational kinds of things in the Old Testament prepare the way for this ultimate manifestation of God making himself part of creation everlastingly in the incarnation.
Yeah, and that's why, Numbers 32 is about the sacraments, which you didn't know.
Yeah, which you didn't know, exactly. So anyway, that's a kind of a recap and a few thoughts more about Numbers 32. Now, Numbers 33, moving along, has got a couple of main sections to it. This is the first part of the chapter, actually the main part of the chapter, the first 49 verses fall into a genre that's known as the itinerary genre, which is just basically means that it's going to be a record of the places where they journeyed from and to. And this is actually documented. So this particular way of describing traveling or journeying is not unique to Numbers chapter 33. There are documents from Assyria that date to around the 9th century. So they are later than Numbers, but still part of that whole culture of the Near East, that have an itinerary genre that's very similar to exactly what we find here in the book of Numbers, where you have basically, okay, we start at A and then we go to B, and then B becomes A in the next section, and B to C, and then go from C to D. So that's the way this is all set up. And also interspersed in there might be on occasion some comments like verse 14. Now it was at Rephidim that the people had no water to drink. So they don't not only say, okay, they go from here to here to, and from here to there and from there to the next place, but they also insert on occasion these comments about maybe something that happened there or some geographical feature of the place. So these 9th century Assyrian documents do the exact same thing. So we have a parallel to what happens in Numbers 33 and some other, not just in those Assyrian documents, but in some other documents as well from Egypt and from elsewhere. So this is, in other words, this is part of kind of the way that the people of that time, of that culture, described the way they journeyed from place to place. So that picks it up. That's that rule. The travel begins really in verse 5. It's introduced with a kind of a brief recap of how it all got started. It starts out verse 1. These are the journeys or the travels of the Israelites by which they came out of the land of Egypt by their armies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. So that kind of sets the stage as to what's going to happen later, the kind of the heading of the chapter. And it says Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys. And so Moses is designated here then as the one, he kept track, right? He was the secretary, if you will. He kept track of all these places that they went to. And verse 3 says it started on the 15th day of the first month on the Passover when they came out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians. Literally, that's like with uplifted hand. You can kind of picture this sign of victory or bold defiance, if you will. The Israelites coming out in the presence of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down. So this real stark contrast here. So here are the Israelites who had been slaves, now marching defiantly out of Egypt. And that's the one picture. And then the other side of the picture are the Egyptians who had been the masters and the persecutors. Now they are burying their firstborn sons. So you have this reversal that the Lord puts into place, where the high and mighty and the powerful are brought low, and the low and the powerless and the suffering are brought high. So this is that theme of great reversal that we see all the way through the scriptures, that Mary herself sings about in the Magnificat, where, you know, the lofty are brought down and the lowly are lifted up. That's the way that the Lord works. And we have this other phrase that we talked about a long time ago, back in Exodus chapter 12. It just pops up here in verse 4 of Numbers 33. It said, the Lord also executed judgment on their gods. So you have to remember when you're thinking about the 10 plagues, that these plagues were not simply directed against the people, against the Egyptians, against the ones who had held the Israelites in bondage, but it was also directed against the gods that the Egyptians themselves were in bondage to. And that's the reason that the plagues fall out the way they do. The Nile and the gnats and the frogs and all the various elements of creation that were used by God to plague Egypt, all of those various elements of creation in one way or another were iconic of the Egyptian gods at the time. You think of the Nile, for instance. Well, there was nothing more important than the Nile for Egypt. If the Nile did not exist, Egypt would not exist, because it was annual flooding of the Nile that was the means by which Egypt was able to produce the crops that they did. So no Nile, no Egypt. And that, so the Nile was understood to be the embodiment of one of the Egyptian gods. It was sort of it was the lifeblood of Egypt. Well, so when God transforms that into blood, this is his way of basically saying, well, I'll show you what a puny god that Egyptian god is, because I can turn his waters into blood. So this is the Lord's way of pronouncing judgments on the Egyptian gods, and also, kind of to sync with what we said earlier, demonstrating that he is the true creator. And he does that by using that which he has created and which idolaters have deified, to show that it is nothing more than something of his own creation, and thus under his power.
It's a judgment on their gods by the fact that their gods are unable to help them in these situations, mm-hmm. right? When you're being struck by plagues and you believe in, you know, any number of different deities, and those deities don't show up, or at the very least are objectively powerless to stop it, well, your deity has sort of been exposed as being weak. You know, you see this sort of, I mean, one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament is when they put the ark in the same room with Dagon, and he just keeps like falling over, like yeah. busting his hands off and stuff, you know, and it's just amazing.
Even the false gods have to bow down in front of the true God, right? Yeah, he can't even stand upright. He just falls over.
Yeah. Yeah, just showing like what a weak god you have.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that too with another story when Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal the contest, right? So they both set up altars, and the reason that story is like this story is because Baal was the god of the sky; he was the god of thunder, and so if anybody should have been able to send down lightning and start the sacrifice, well, it should have been Baal. I mean, what else would the lightning sky god do? And yet, of course, he doesn't. And then Elijah's like, yeah, I think I'm gonna pour like a whole bunch of water on my sacrifice.
Yeah, like hundreds of gallons.
Yeah, hundreds of gallons. And then fire comes down and reduces it all to ashes. So if you ever wonder about humor in the Bible, just read that story, because it's hilarious. Yeah, especially when you listen to Elijah call louder, maybe cut yourself some more. Maybe your God has gone to the restroom for a while, or maybe he's asleep. Maybe you need to holler a little bit louder. He's just mocking them mercilessly.
Yeah. Yep. God is in the he's in the business of exposing your ridiculous God.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what Psalm 2 says. I mean, in one of the few places in the Bible where it says the Lord laughs, Psalm 2 is where he laughs. He laughs at the falsities of the gods of the pagan peoples and the peoples themselves who have sworn allegiance to those false gods. So, yeah, I mean, idolatry angers God, but it also makes him laugh in derision at the falsity of it all. Okay. So back to Numbers 33, the Lord executed these judgments against their gods. Then verse 5, we start the travel itinerary. It's basically broken up into three different sections. Verses 5 through 15 document the journey through all the various campsites, from when they left Egypt until they reached the wilderness of Sinai. And then verses 16 and 17 are when they're actually at Sinai, and then they leave going to Kadesh. And then from there, from verses 18 through 49, basically cover almost 38 years. This is where they were during their years of traveling around through the wilderness. So that's the travel itinerary. So we were here for a while, and then we went somewhere else. And I think there's only one verse that says how long they stayed at a place. Most of these don't say, you know, did they camp there overnight? Were they a week? Were they there for a year? Well, we really don't know. All we know is that they went from one place to another. Now, as to why this is recorded, I was reading a commentary by the medieval Jewish scholar named Maimonides, and I thought he had a great point here. He said basically this travel itinerary is one of the reasons it's here is, you know, in case later generations ever wondered, well, exactly where were the Israelites? I mean, were they like close to some nice land? Were they a place where they could, you know, where there's a lot of pasture land or there's a lot of water? No, they were in the middle of nowhere. And because they were in the middle of nowhere, the only way they could get food and water was through the manna and through the water rock from which God provided water for them. So this was, according to Maimonides, one of the reasons this was recorded, these place names are recorded so as to make sure that later generations of Israelites knew that the only way that the Israelites are going to make it from place to place in these in this desolate area is through the Lord's provision and through his provision alone. So which I think made sense to me. Can't think of anything else that I wanted to comment on regarding the travel itinerary. So that ends at verse 49. Now, the last half of the chapter, which is only about six verses, is a repetition of the command that we've encountered before, that when the Israelites get into the promised land, they're not to cozy up with the pagan inhabitants.
It's funny that this has to be reiterated so many times. But
yeah, it's like Moses is like, I know, I have a bad feeling about what's coming, so I'm going to say this again.
this is an objective problem but this is most certainly a problem that you will see over and over again in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and you know this is also one of those things that never was faithfully and completely followed. Never. They were supposed to go in and eradicate all the nations and drive them out and establish the boundaries of Israel, not to intermarry with these pagan peoples, not to be enticed to participate in their idolatrous worship. And yet, time and time and time again, that's exactly what happened. In fact, where is it at? I think it was 1 Kings chapter 9 I was looking at this morning. And it's when Solomon is building the temple. And it says that some of the people that he used to help build the temple were among the pagan nations that they had. It basically turned them into slaves. So those who were still in the land, I mean, this is like centuries later, these descendants of the original Canaanites, Solomon turned into slaves to help build his mansion and the temple. So in other words, they were still there, right? Nothing. They never did completely drive out all these nations.
Yeah, well, Solomon's a good example of this. He's like the wisest man that ever lived and still can't obey this command. Because, yeah. I mean, he intermarries and worships all these gods and has all this stuff going on.
He married foreign wives and he wanted to keep them happy. So he built temples to their gods. And lo and behold, look what happened, you know. That was the beginning of the end for Israel. So back to Numbers, just to reaffirm exactly what is said here. The Lord is speaking through Moses and says, look, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then I want you to do three things. I want you to drive out the inhabitants of the land. I want you to destroy all their figured stones. And I want you to destroy and demolish their molten images and their high places. So there's a twofold destruction that goes on. Not only do I want you to drive out the peoples, but everything that remains of their worship sites, of their idolatrous worship sites, whether that is the altars or their images or their Asherah poles or whatever it might be, I want you to completely wipe it out. So I don't want these still remaining as temptations or pollutants upon the land. I want you to destroy them utterly. And then, after you've done that, you take possession of the land. And this is the way I want you to divide it out. You know, the borders of each tribe were determined by lot. But then, depending on how big or how small the clans were, they were given either smaller or larger portions of land within that allotted tribal amount. And then verse 55. He says it again. If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you. Then it shall come about that those whom you let remain will become as thorns, as pricks in your eyes, and as thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. And it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you. So I plan to destroy them, and if you don't follow my commands, then I will end up destroying you, which is, in the long perspective, exactly what happened to Israel. This language, by the way, of thorns in your eyes and in your sides comes up a couple other times. It comes up in Joshua, and I believe it comes up in Ezekiel. And I wonder if this is not kind of the background of what Paul is talking about in 2 Corinthians 12 when he talks about a thorn in his side. I know the Greek word for thorn that Paul uses is, I believe, the same word that's used here as well in verse 55 in the Greek translation. So that could be the image that Paul was drawing from when he was talking about this thorn in his side that the Lord let remain to trouble him.
Yeah. So I think that and this might just be obvious, but you don't hear thorn in your eye very often. And I think that if you just think about this for a second, you get the idea of what God is saying. Like, if you don't get rid of this stuff, you're not going to be able to see clearly. I don't know if you think about this, but if you have a thorn in your eyeball, that's going to impair your sight. I would assume you are not going to be able to see clearly, and so this will impair your spiritual vision, as it were, if you have the stuff, and it's going to be a long term nuisance to you. So a thorn in your side, it would just think about having just a massive splinter or something. It's like having a rock in your shoe. It's going to be a nuisance. So it's going to impair your ability to see clearly, spiritually speaking, and it's going to be a physical nuisance to you. Thorn in your side is a term that has somehow stayed around. We still use that today. If someone's a thorn in your side, it's that person that won't leave you alone.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that constant irritant. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a meme once where it had Paul chained up, and then chained up next to him was SpongeBob, and he's saying, "The Lord gave me a thorn in my side," and SpongeBob's going, "Hey Paul, hey Paul, like you guys know about this."
Every time I see that meme, I crack up because it's so true. Hey Paul, where are you riding? Hey Paul. Yeah, I mean that's one of those images that is lifted from Scripture and that people use all the time. And I would bet that probably 90% of people who use that phrase have no idea that it actually comes from the Scriptures.
Right.
But that just shows the way that the Bible has worked its way into everyday speech and become so much a part of our language that often we don't even realize the original source of it. Okay, so that's the end of chapter 33. This is the travel itinerary, and hey, once you're finished traveling and you cross the Jordan, then do what I say. Otherwise, you're not gonna be able to see very well, and you're gonna have this huge splint in your side, which won't be fun. So listen to my word. All right, chapter 34. We're gonna go into a little bit different section now. This is not the most stimulating of material, but it is significant. It's important in its own way. Basically, it is drawing out the borders of the land that the Lord is giving to them. And we won't get into all these rather complicated issues of the various border lines that are actually drawn up here and in Deuteronomy and elsewhere. The borders of Israel were constantly changing. You kind of have, I guess, what you might call an ideal here. But this ideal in Numbers was actually, at least according to the knowledge we have from Scripture, was never actually fully implemented or realized by Israel. Probably I might get this wrong, but I think that the greatest extent of land ever controlled by Israel was during the reign of David. Seemed like there might have been another king that took it farther. But anyway, either the height or almost the height of Israel occupation and control of land, both of their own land and of some of the surrounding areas, was during the reign of David. But earlier than that, I mean, you had all sorts of problems. Of course, we get into this with Joshua and Judges, where they weren't able to conquer some cities. They weren't able to conquer some territories. Other ones, they just gave up and compromised with the original inhabitants of the land and ended up bringing trouble into Israel. But this is, in numbers anyway, this is kind of the ideal. This is God basically, you know, staking out for them their borders. This is the extent of your land. And then at the end of that chapter, we have in verses 16 through 29, we have a list of the various tribal leaders that are going to be involved in the process of dividing up the land and choosing by lot and making sure that everything goes according to the way that God wants it to go. And these names are listed in approximately from south to north. So the southernmost tribe is one of the first listed, and the last in this list is one of the northernmost tribes. So they kind of begin south and work their way up to the north in the names of these leaders according to the visions of the land in the tribes of Israel. And the land division is important for practical reasons, of course, because the Israelites need to know, okay, this is the land that God is giving to us. So it goes from here, and then it stretches over to the east there, and then it follows along the Jordan River all the way down here to the south, and then back over to the Mediterranean Sea. So there is a very specific landmass that the Lord is giving to the Israelites. He's not saying to them, you know, the world is yours. He's saying this particular plot of land, I am giving this to you. But it's good to, when you read chapters like this, to also keep in mind that this is a small part of a much larger story, and that the story of land is something that we have encountered already in the beginning. We alluded to it earlier when we talked about Eden. So God makes the whole earth, but he gives Adam and Eve their own holy land, their own special place, where it's like the first temple. Eden is like the first temple. This is the place where God dwells with his people. And then later, here in the book of Numbers, he's going to give them a much larger land, the land of Israel. But even that is not the ultimate goal that God has, because what's going to happen at the coming of the Messiah is he's going to say to his disciples, hey, I want you to go out into all nations, into all the world. And as he tells the woman of Samaria, you know, it's coming a time when my worshipers aren't going to worship me either on your mountain or in Jerusalem, but they're going to worship me in spirit and truth. In other words, there's no longer going to be geographical boundaries as to where the Holy Land is. Instead, it's going to be all over the world, every place, wherever the Lord's gospel is preached, there he's establishing his temple, his Holy Land. So all of this is nothing but the preparation for what is to come. God is going to raise up the people of Israel on this land, but not as if that is the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is for them to spread out from there and to take that blessing to Abraham, to all nations, so that all nations in his seed will be able to be part of the people of God.
And that is it, man. That is 40 minutes right there.
Perfect.
Perfect timing. Guys, if you want to come hang out with me and Chad in Austin, Texas, again, you can do that March 9th. Me and him will both be there along with a bunch of other people. It's free. We'd like to see you. And Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, man. We'll see you then. Thanks.